Okay. Well, good evening. Welcome to the first class, the first part in a series called Mishle and Modern Psychology. I'll tell you that this class is something I've been thinking about giving for maybe 5 years, and I've never found a good time to do it. And Baruch Hashem, we've had a good group here, and you all are willing to come by and listen. And I'm sorry, I only made about, 15 to 20 sheets, so hopefully we have enough. But we'll go through it line by line. And really, this first class is going to be an introduction, but conveniently enough, the book itself has an introduction. Meaning the first few psukim that we'll read tonight, Shlomo HaMelech basically uses as his opportunity to introduce what he's going to do. So first of all, obviously Shlomo HaMelech wrote it, but when did he write it? Anyone know when did Shlomo HaMelech write Mishle? So there's no wrong answer here. Yeah.
I thought I remember that near the end of his life, he uttered Mishle, I can't remember, Kohelis, and something else.
So there, the truth is,
down for him, they wrote down what he said.
Different Ma'amari Chazal, you say different things. I think the most conventional understanding, that's a hard thing to say. I think that the way that he might have written it down was first Shir HaShirin. Some people say when you're younger, you have more optimism, you know, young love, that kind of concept. So he wrote Shir HaShirin, which is a love story between Hashem and the Jewish people. Very symbolic, very poetic. And then the end of his life, although this is not necessarily the nicest thing to say, some people say he became a little more cynical about life, and he wrote Ecclesiastes, he wrote Kohelet, about the things that are vain, the things that are worthwhile. And obviously the Sof Tavar HaKol Nishma, everything in the end is about Hashem. And then in the middle, where he's sort of in the middle of his life, he's seen the good stuff, he's seen some things that have brought him down from the clouds after Shir HaShirim, now he's in reality, right? This is the mainstay of his life, and that's when he writes Mishle. When he has his wisdom, he's seen the world, he's experienced the world, now he has what to talk about in terms of how it operates. Specifically within a Jewish context, of course. And as we know, the word that he starts with is Mishle. What does the word Mishle mean? A mushel, a parable. So there's a famous person who gave parables. His name was the Dubna Magid, Rabbi Yaakov Krantz. And he used to say a parable to explain the power of a parable. There are a bunch of these, actually. And he says that a man was once walking in the woods, and he sees these trees with targets on them. And in every single target, there's an arrow right in the bullseye. And he sees this boy carrying a bow and arrow. And he goes to the boy, he says, "How in the world did you do this every single time? Are you that good of an archer? How could you do that?" He says, "You're assuming that I drew the bullseye and then I shot the arrow. First I shoot the arrow and then I draw the bullseye." So the Dubna Magid used to say, "I have all these mashalim, I have all of these parables. It's just a matter of how to apply them." And that's how he said he always had a good parable for every lesson, because he had good parables. So Shlomo HaMelech, in this book, gives us a lot of parables. More, we can call them less parables, more illustrations. How things operate within the world through different images, through different examples that we are familiar with. There are a few different mashalim that the Mefarshim talk about in terms of what the power of a parable is. One of them is famous in the Ramchal. So I think Rabbeinu Yonah might point this out. He says that imagine you're walking in the darkness and you're trying to look for a precious stone. And it's dark everywhere, you don't know where you're going. All of a sudden there's a bolt of lightning, right? Or a match is struck for a split second, and you can catch a glimpse at where the stone is. He says that's a mashal. A mashal is not going to tell you exactly what it is, but it's going to give you a picture, it's going to give you a sense, it's going to give you something to relate to in order to find the pearl. If you look at source number 3, the Malbim gives us a different mashal. He gives us a different mashal to understand a mashal. And it's a really beautiful mashal. It's part of the title that you see at the top of the page. The Malbim says the following: Mishle b'chol davar yesh chomer tzura poel tachlis. That there is a form, and there's the person that acts on the form, and then there's the goal of the form. There's matter. So here he says, al pizeh yomer ki chomer hasefer hu mishle, or mashale. That the form of this book are parables. That's the construct that Shlomo HaMelech is going to be working through in order to teach us about life. Shem kvutzat mashalim. It's a collection of mashalim. Shelahalim shelahavin devarim situmim va'amukim habilti nodaim. In order to understand lahavin devarim situmim, covered up things you can't necessarily understand, va'amukim and deep ideas, habilti nodaim, things that people don't really understand. Yamtzi lehem mashal midvarim hanodaim. How do you understand them? In order to understand them, you bring something that people do understand. A story, a relationship, some kind of context in the real world that we can connect to. And then he says the following. Shederech halavush shel hamashal hanoda yuvat hamitlabish shehu hanimshal. It's a beautiful line. He says that the way of clothing is to make it clear the form of that which is clothed. Right? You can imagine a mannequin is dressed up in all winter clothing. Right? The mannequin is advertising ski gear. Right? So you have no idea what the mannequin underneath looks like. But you know what the clothes look like. So the clothing gives you the form of what the underneath might look like. So says the Malbim, that's the same thing with a mashal. A parable gives you the form, even if it can't fully encapsulate the meaning or the depth of the knowledge of this world, at least it gives you the clothing. It gives you a certain sense of how to relate to this idea. And through that, you can understand concepts which are deeper than usually you would usually be able to understand them. So, the modern psychology part of this, we're not always going to have something to connect to. But I've been reading, or I most recently read a book called Made to Stick by two brothers, Chip and Dan Heath. I don't know if people are familiar with Chip and Dan Heath. I'm a big fan of them. They have many books about modern, you know, world and how to be better people. And in source number two, you find that in one of the books they wrote called Made to Stick, which is a book all about how to make ideas stick in the people you're talking to. So one of the six principles that they have there is the use of stories. I said on Shabbos in my afternoon shiur that one of the best, the most memorable things in a drasha are the jokes and the stories. Unfortunately, that's the part that sticks better than the Torah aspect, but hopefully the stories help, you know, bolster the memory of the Torah too. And they say there, one of the elements is stories. Why? Stories show how context can mislead people to make the wrong decisions. Stories illustrate causal relationships that people hadn't recognized before and highlighted the unexpected, resourceful ways in which people have solved problems. So while you're talking about a concept, which is very theoretical, very difficult, intangible, if you can connect it to a story, you can put it into a relatable context with more tangible figures, more tangible elements, so you can then understand the broader picture of how this concept can be, you know, relatable into real life. So that's the process of the parable. Yeah, Steve.
It would seem from the way they said it, it would also distort the reality of the subject matter. So in the case of your mannequin,
right,
what you build up on that outside, you might.
It's true. It's true. Yeah, and that's why all of the parables aren't telling you you're going to find the precious stone, or you're definitely going to know what the mannequin looks like, because it's always going to be a little bit a step removed. The only way you can truly understand the concept of self is by explaining the concept of self, but these are too deep to understand, so at least we have a picture, we have a form, we have some kind of idea about what is underneath. But you're right, and I have a friend who has a pet peeve that when people use parables, oftentimes the parable doesn't make any sense. So he says, you've undone your own cause by explaining something with something that doesn't make any sense. So even if, you know, the parallel elements of it, you know, make sense, you have to have the parable itself make sense, whatever. But maybe we'll get into some of those a little bit later. So the beginning of Mishlei Shlomo ben David, Melech Yisrael. These are the parables of Solomon, the son of David, the king of Israel. So it's interesting that we need all these descriptors. This is not a biographical work. So the Gra points out a very interesting line. And this is also something put in that Chip and Dan Heath talk about. He says the following: Ki halomed b'sefer sarach leida mihu hamechabro. When you're going to read a book, you have to know who wrote it. Why? Ki im yihye hamechaber gadol b'chachma bevadei yebesifer chachmos gadolos. If you know that the person is a wise person, so then you know what he's writing is wise, right? So this is what Chip and Dan Heath call credibility. that in order to make something memorable, you have to give it credibility. You can't just say it and pretend like it's from God. You have to give it either, statistics, you have to give it tangible examples that people can relate to, give it more credence, more credibility, and that's what's going on in this first pasuk. But you could have said, just say Mishlei Shlomo. These are the parables of Solomon. We know Solomon. Why does it have to say Ben David and Melech Yisrael? So the Gra goes into why that's the case. And this is also as a means of introduction. There are three sections of Mishlei. The first 9 chapters of Mishlei are all about what we call Chachma. Right? We call just knowledge, understanding. And this is what the Gra says, who has a kan gimel sfarim shin gimel mashalei aleph al chachma, v'habeis al musar, right, character traits, that's chapters 10 until 24. And then he says, the last one is Torah. How does this all relate to a godly life, a divinely inspired lifestyle? So that's coming up in chapter 25 till the end, 31. Hopefully we'll get there in a few years. But for now, those are the three aspects that Shlomo HaMelech is going to be teaching. And he says each one of these identifiers is a reference to his credibility in each aspect. How? Shlomo, we know, was the wisest of all men. Anyone who's read Tanakh, who's read Nevi'im about Shlomo HaMelech knows Shlomo HaMelech was the wisest of all men. It's pretty clear in Tanakh. So that's Shlomo. Right, you can trust the parts of this book. The first 9 chapters you can trust are very wise. They're full of wisdom because they're coming from Shlomo. And then we have Ben David. He's the son of David. Who was David? As the Gra points out, the Vilna Gaon says that the Gemara in Brachos tells us that if someone sees David HaMelech in a dream, not that we would know what he looks like, but if you would somehow know it was David HaMelech, so what does that mean? Yitzapel HaChasidus. That you're clearly in, you're seeking out piety. That David was sort of the paradigm of piety, that if we would see him in a dream, that's one of our longings, that we personally want to be more pious. So that's why it says Ben David, because those next chapters of 10 through 23, of 10 through 24, are all teaching you about piety. And he's the son of David, the paradigm of piety. And then what's Melech Yisrael, the king of Israel? So he says, as you might expect, Bi Melachim Yimlochu, that the kings are going to be leading the Jewish people in a country of Torah lifestyles, right? It's not like we have today, where the Israeli government, while it's very beneficial for the Jewish people and gives us many opportunities we've never had in our history, it's in no way a religious government, which is part of why there's a lot of controversy about it. Right, but when the king of Israel is hopefully once again soon enough established, and we have a monarchy which we never had before, or we haven't had in many years, so it's going to be a country, it's going to be a people which is dictated by Torah values, and that's the responsibility of the king. So that's why these three indicators, these three identifiers, are here to teach us that each one is telling us the credibility of what he's going to teach.
David. He couldn't build the base of Mikdash, not because of his piety or whatever. He was a bloody king.
Yeah, well, that's why he couldn't. So if it was for his piety, he would be able to.
Why do we emulate it? Why do we mention him as a good guy to follow?
The fact that he had blood on his hands because he won wars doesn't mean he's a bad guy. It means he was just a warrior. We want the base of Mikdash to be built by a peaceful person through peace. He was doing what he had to do. The fact that he won wars was a good thing. It's just that he wasn't. It wasn't made through peace. But it's an interesting question as to how we understand David's life. But we reference the Beis Hamikdash to David also, right? On Sukkot, we say Sukkas David Hanofel. We don't say Sukkas Shlomo. We say we should bring back. Yeah, exactly. So this is the beginning of Mishlei. If you look at source number 4, you find the next couple lines. He's going to talk about here what exactly he's trying to teach. You look in source number 4, he says in Psukim, Beis, and Gimel, Ladas Chachma Umusar, Lahavin Imrevina. What does that mean? To learn Chachma Umusar, wisdom, and this translation says discipline, character building, and Lahavin Imrevina. It's kind of a repetitive phrase. They're both Bina, right? Lahavin means to understand, Bina means understanding. So that's one thing he's trying to do, to understand. He's bringing all these parables in order to understand, to know wisdom and discipline, and to understand this as discernment, how to understand something. And the next part, lakachas musar haskel, to take discipline for success, which is an interesting translation here. Tzedek umishpat umesharim. Justice, righteousness, justice, and equity. So these are very interesting because Rashi has a completely different understanding of this word, ladat. While we would usually translate ladat as to know, Rashi translates it, for some reason, as lehodia, to teach. He says, Hamashalim ha'elu, in source number 5, Amar lehodia lebriot, chachma umusar, to teach to other people the concept of knowledge and of character building. Which is interesting because we consider Shlomo to be the teacher in this situation. We're reading Mishlei to hear what Shlomo has to say. But Shlomo says, no, I'm teaching you so that you can teach others. According to Rashi, that's how Rashi understands it. Right, you're giving them tools. Right, exactly. You're giving them tools to give to other people. Teaching them the stories that can understand, that can help other people understand. But then you have to understand, what does the word then mean? Ladat chachma umusar lahavin imrevina. To teach wisdom and character building so that you understand things that are difficult to understand. What would that mean? So I don't know for sure. But I'll tell you that for me, the best way for me to ever understand something is to teach it. I don't know if anyone has ever had this feeling, but in order to really understand, you have to force yourself to teach it. Oftentimes, I'll have a drasha in mind, and I won't know if it's good or it's not good, if I'm going to give it over or not. The second I say it over, I know if it's good or not. The second I say it to my wife or somebody else, I'll know whether or not. Just literally, the second I try to start explaining it, I'll know if it's a good drasha. And it's because when you have to manifest it outside to another person so that they can understand it, you can really, you force yourself to understand it yourself. That's the best way to learn. So maybe that's what it means, according to Rashi, ladas chachma musar, to teach chachma musar in order to understand it. So it's not necessarily just to teach it to other people, but also to understand it yourself. If you look at the Malbin says a very interesting piece. He says that there's a difference between bina and chachma. Right? We know this, right? What is chachma, bina, and das? There are three levels of understanding. What do you think, Michael?
Chachma is the actual knowledge.
Okay.
Bina is internalizing it and understanding it at a deeper level. And das is to be able to reorganize and give it to others.
Okay. Okay, so a lot of... you're on the right track. You're definitely on the right track. It's unclear to me. Different commentaries sort of categorize them differently, but you're definitely on the right track. So according to the Malbin says the following. Tachar she'achachma ne'asefet el hanefesh mibachutz. What is wisdom? What is chachma? That's when you absorb your surroundings, right? You learn about math. You learn about science. You're absorbing all of that. That's just tangible knowledge, right? Physical, hardwired memory. Good. We're going to get to that. That's a good point. He says, "Habina, while knowledge is absorbing, bina is yotzeit minefesh ha'adam lachutz. Bina is the ability to discern from within what you see without. Right? So you see something outside. You're using your own capacities to understand what that is. It's not someone telling you that 2 + 2 = 4. It's you see a bunch of trees." And then you can count them yourself, right? You're adding your own. Maybe that wouldn't be a good example, but you get the idea that you're using some kind of internal capacity in order to understand what's outside of you. That's how he understands it, and therefore you can understand in the pasuk it says la da chachma umusar. I'm going to give you the wisdom that you should know. Just basic concepts, and through that you'll be able lahavin. To understand, you'll use your bina to apply it into the outside world. That also makes sense based on the next words, lakachat musar haskel. And therefore, you will be able to take. What is the word take referring to here? You're going to take it with you. right? I'm going to give you the tools, the basic knowledge, so that you can understand, so you can take it with you to the outside. And the Rabbeinu Yonah points out that in this situation, lakachat musar haskel, or I should say the Gra points out that lakachat musar haskel is a reference. Haskel means not just musar, but successful musar, right? Oftentimes, you'll hear a good fiery drasha, and they'll say, you got to do X, Y, and Z. Then you go home and you try to apply it, and everybody gets upset at you. Right? I don't know if anyone's having this. You can't say any Lashon Hara. So then you get to your dinner table, someone wants to talk about something that happened in politics. No, I can't listen to it. And then they try to talk about sports. No, I can't listen to it. Right? You took it to such an extreme. You took the muster, but it's not haskel. It's not successful muster. It's a muster that you're applying in irresponsible ways. Lakachat musar haskel means to take muster successfully. Because the pasuk right beforehand already said, I'm going to give you musar. Right? You saw a source in verse number 2. In Bet, it said, ladat chachma u'musar, to know knowledge and musar. Now it's saying, lakachat musar again, but this is musar haskel. This is how to apply it. You're taking it with you, like I said before from Rabbeinu Yonah, you're taking it with you and applying it successfully. And the Gra says, how do you apply it successfully? That's the last three words of the pasuk. Tzedek, mishpat, and meisharim. What's tzedek? Righteousness, piety. You're being a nice guy. This can also be applied in extreme ways to your own detriment, right? Someone comes over with the pushka, right? So you say, clear out my bank account. I'm a nice guy today. I'm feeling good today. Well, that's not going to work, right? That might be tzedakah, but it's not haskel. It's not successful tzedakah, right? So what do you have to do? You have to have tzedek and mishpat. You have to be pious, you have to be righteous, but it also has to be tempered, it has to be balanced with mishpat, right? With a sense of justice. It wouldn't be fair to you or your family if you gave away all your money, right? So you have to apply the mishpat and the tzedek together. Yeah.
Another translation for a skill.
Yeah.
Logic.
Yeah, yeah. So some commentaries point out that it refers to seichel, right? Use your seichel. Right? As your Babi tells you. Right? Use your seichel, right? Use common sense. So that's another way. It's a wrinkle, but I think it also applies in a similar way, which is you take the muster, but you apply it in a logical way.
It's moving forward with the piece of information and the understanding.
Applying it with common sense. Yeah, very good. Yeah.
Enforce it on other people. I mean,
that's true too. It would be interesting how Rashi would understand that with the first part, right? Rashi says, ladat chachmu musar means that he's giving it to you to teach it to others. So it would be an interesting way to put a wrinkle in here. Lakachat musar, you take it for yourself, but how you apply it to others would be an interesting separate calculation. Yeah?
Can you apply this to what Rabbi Katz says regarding chachmu binadas, that chachmu would be the masculine way Hashem gives us? We receive it, which is the bina,
mm-hmm.
like the grain is the chokmah. We receive it, which we make it into bread, and we do mitzvahs with that strength.
So the bina is the woman.
The female, and the sort in the home. The father typically.
Good.
Is the
interesting.
The woman
brings it up to the kids. So the man brings it all in. Like the knowledge is absorbing the environment, then you give it over to the woman, who can apply it internally, and then the dad is applying it in life broadly. I like that. Nice. I'm not so familiar with Rabbi Tatz, although I have heard that idea from him. I think it's throughout a lot of his books he has that concept. But yeah, that sounds like a good idea. There's one inhibiting factor to this. And that is something that you'll find in another book I read a few months ago called Thinking Fast and Slow. Does anyone know this book? Daniel Kahneman? Is that a hand raise, Larry?
No.
You read it? It's a very dense book. I couldn't get through it myself. I read probably about half of it. I hope to return to it. I mean, I got through it and then I had to give it back to the library. But it's very dense. He's an Israeli guy. He writes this book with a friend of his called Amos. And he says it's all about how we think. And he says the following. Very interesting. I'd be interested to hear everyone's take on this. He says in source number 7, more education is associated with higher evaluation of one's life, meaning we think about ourselves more. The more we know, the more we judge ourselves. But not with greater experienced well-being. Indeed, at least in the United States, the more educated tend to report higher stress. Anyone ever familiar with this? Yeah. The more you know, the more difficult it is to get along in life, because you're just constantly thinking about, did I do this right? Did I do this wrong? Can I do this better? Did I do this worse? How do I do better in the future? Things like that. This is, in other words, ignorance is bliss, right? In this sense, the less you know, the easier off you'll be. But the question is, how does this apply to Shlomo? Shlomo's saying, I'm going to tell you all this stuff. Well, maybe I don't want to know all this stuff. Maybe this is not such a good thing to know, right? Maybe I'll keep my ignorance. I won't learn anything. I won't learn how to be a good person, and then I'll just live blissfully.
So in the order that you said it before,
yeah,
going through what he is now may bring you to Kohelas, but if you carry it all the way through, then you get soaked up around.
Okay, maybe. Maybe that's true.
Seder for Kohelas.
Okay. We'll do Kohelas next then. No, that could be a good point. But look at the Malbim, because I think this is very in line with modern thinking and sort of the counterculture to modern thinking. The Malbim says the following. If you look a few lines down, let's go to the bold in the second line of the Malbim in source number 8. The Malbim says, Ki yetzer lev ha'adam ra minu rav. This is from the beginning of the Torah where Hashem gets all mad at the Jewish, at the people on earth and the flood, etc. Halev yala tziurim lihitka'ot lekina linakama lihitachzar v'chadome. The heart drives you to do all these terrible things, or to all these risky character traits. Ve'ela hatziurim haraim olim mi'atzmam el halev. They just come up naturally. Ve'al yadam yilachamu hakoach hamitavev hamitorerim hachachma. And all these inclinations fight with your knowledge, with your greater understanding of what you're supposed to be doing. V'adam yateh achareim b'tivo. And he's just naturally drawn to them. Basha ein al chukei chachma muftei hadat. Ad she'iyev shar she'yamod negdam b'koach hadat. You can't fight against it anymore. V'chein lo yilachem negdam mitzad tivo nafsho. And you can't, and there's nothing naturally pulling you away from these bad character traits. Ki nafochu she'chukei chachma sotrim al tevo nefesh. Lachain sarachu lemusar. That's why you need musar. What is the word musar? Here is the kicker. V'hu sheyiyaser v'yeesor kolchot nafsho. What does the word asor mean? Prohibited. But in a more literal sense, la'esor means like matir asurim, to bind. To be oser means to bind, to constrict, to prohibit. Right? An isser is a prohibition because it inhibits our ability to do something. So he says that's the same word as musser. Musser means the ability to hold ourselves back, to bind ourselves. You have some kind of inclination which is, you know, tending towards something bad. You're binding it in. You're not allowing it out. Right? You're restricting yourself. Yasherad v'yasor kochot nafsho bal yalizu mechukei achachma lo et sheyivchar derech hastichlos. You're not going to go into do terrible things. V'lo el shekochos nafsho hanotim l'tov yatzu v'yispashtu chutz migvul shegav l'alham achachma. And they're not going to go over the boundaries that, and similarly, they're not going to go over the boundaries in another way. You're not going to become too pious. Muster goes both ways. It's not just to hold you back from eating the cookie, but it's also to hold you back from fasting every day and never talking to anyone and things like that, right? It goes in both directions. It's about finding that balance, as we said before. So that's what the word musar comes from, the word usser. It's the same word. What's fascinating, guys, I don't know if people are familiar with the educational director of the OU. His name is David Beshevkin. He wrote a very interesting book recently called Synagogue. He spells it S-I-N-A-G-O-G-U-E. It's all about the concept of failure in life and how we can harness it for the better. Some like what I spoke about on Shabbos. But I like to call him a friend. He's a little older than me, but a very knowledgeable person. And he does a lot with millennials because he works closely with NCSY. And he said what's interesting about even the English language is that nowadays, well, I'll say this first, that the English language, the words of decide, the word decide is closely related to other words. What other words end with side?
Deicide, killing.
Deicide, suicide, homicide. What does the suffix side mean?
Death.
It means to cut off, to end something. When we decide something, what we're doing is we're cutting off everything else. We're saying, I'm not choosing any of those other things. And in Hebrew also, Rabbi Beshefkin points out, the word livchor, like bocher, to choose, is connected to the word chara, which means to destroy. It's the same, he says from, I think he said from Shimshon and Frau Hirsch. It's the same word in Hebrew. That when we choose to do something, what we're doing is we're restricting ourselves from other things. Right? As we say when we get married, right? Shehitzer lanu es ha-nesuos lanu, v'asar lanu es ha-rusos. What does marriage mean? It means I'm cutting off everybody else. I'm not going to have anything to do with them anymore. Cherem. It could be a similar word. Charam, or cherem, is to excommunicate. So, in a similar way, this is also, potentially, what Daniel Kahneman is saying when he says, the more knowledge you have, the more stress you have. Because you're making decisions as to what you're going to let in, what you're going to let out. You're restricting yourself. It's very stressful to restrict yourself. And in many ways, Rav David Beshefkin points out that people nowadays are dealing with this more than anything else. The concepts of restriction are harder and harder as we go more and more advanced in our industrial age, where you can get anything and everything anytime you want it, as soon as you want it. Right? Even today was a special day for the internet, right?
Prime Day.
It was Prime Day. Every year I think about Prime Day and I think I don't need anything. And then a week later I think about what I needed and I should have got a Prime, whatever. So today was Prime Day. What's Prime Day? Anything you want for cheapest prices in just a couple days at your doorstep. You don't have to get off the couch. Get whatever you want. There's an interesting book. I didn't put it down here, but there's a book. Maybe it's also by the Heath brothers. It's called... I think it's called Switch. And they say in there, fascinating studies about people who have to make decisions with many choices and people who have to make decisions with very few choices. They did a study where they were selling jams at a carnival. And they said, I think this is a well-known study, I've seen it in a couple places, that first for the first few hours they gave 24 choices of jams. And they sold very little. Oh yeah? Same study. This is an old study. I guess they reprinted it. And then the next few hours they did only 6 jams. They sold, I think, more than double.
Right.
Because when you restrict the choices for people, they don't feel as guilty getting rid of all the other things. Yeah?
Don't they say if you put dishes of food all around the donkey, you'll starve to death?
There's a famous philosophical debate about the donkey who's momish equidistant between two plates of food. I don't know if it's the same one, but he can't decide between the two, and he'll just die instead. You're right. He dies by lack of decision. But it's a human quality that we all have, that we're always looking for more. Or not just that we're looking for more, but that we're unwilling to restrict ourselves. And this is becoming more and more difficult nowadays with the advancements of technology and the advancements of commerce, that there's so much available, we have difficulty, you know, making decisions.
But none of it works, and it's all becoming, you're having to pay for
it. I'm not saying it's a good thing.
It used to be free.
I'm not saying it's a good thing. But similarly, people apply this to, you know, the Shidduch crisis. They apply this to the Shtiebel crisis, right? All these different crises that are all about not limiting ourselves. I live in 21st century United States. I can have whatever I want, whenever I want it. I don't want to limit myself. I don't want to restrict myself. And in much the same way, that's what Musar is. Musar is cultivating that ability to restrict ourselves. To say, I want something, but I'm going to hold myself back. That's the point of Musar.
And it's the same rule when somebody says, he gave him Musar. Is that the same?
It's the same word. It's the same word. Whether or not the person who's saying it is saying it in that way, I'm not sure. Usually, yes. Musar means I'm giving you musar, I'm telling you what to do, or more usually, I'm telling you what not to do.
Yeah.
Right? When someone says, I'm giving you musar, they're usually telling you what not to do. More often than they're telling you what to do. So let's move on a little bit. The next source we mentioned before, Ben Zoma Omer Ezu Chacham Halomin Biko Adam. This I brought because of Rabbeinu Yonah's understanding of the of Pasuk Gimel Lakachas Musar. You have to take it with you. The way that you take it, Rav Sadok of Lublin says on this pasuk, Lakachas Musar means you got to take it from wherever you can get it. Anyone, whether it's someone in this class, whether it's your crossing guard, whether it's the person at the supermarket, you take it wherever you can get it. That's what it means to take Musar, to be able to understand it and to glean how to live life better. Moving over the page, we pass into the next aspect of Mishlei's introduction, and that is the benefits of the introduction, the benefits of sources 10 and 11 are the same, just without a translation, sorry. But if you look at source number 11, so source number 11 says, Latet leftaim arma lenaar dat umezuma. That what is this book going to do? It's going to give the simple people the ability to discern. It's going to give them the power of what this says is shrewdness. Arma usually means trickery. But here, the word itself actually can be used in positive or negative. Here it means to be shrewd, to understand, and to discern what you should do. And it also gives linar dat umezima. It gives the young the ability to have knowledge and foresight. And what about the people that already know a lot of stuff? So pasuk hey, yishma chacham, and the chacham, the wise person who already knows a lot, what's he going to get? Yosef lekach, first he's going to get more chachma. He's going to get more wisdom. But v'navon tachbulot yikneh. He's also going to get the ability, he's going to acquire tachbulot. What does the word tachbulot mean? So the Ibn Ezra points out in source number 13, we'll say it outside, tachbulot mean is related to the word chevel. What's the word chevel? A rope, right? Chevel is a rope. What does it mean, rope? So he says it's a reference to source number 12. Pasuk says, Vayigash elav Yehuda, that Yehuda is standing in front of Yosef. Right, he's got to convince him to allow to allow Binyamin back, right? And he ultimately, this is when Yosef, you know, reveals himself. Everyone, of course, remembers the weekend that I was here was this Parsha, and I talked all about this, and that's why you hired me. But here's a midrash I didn't talk about. The midrash says the following: Ksiv mayim amukim etza b'lev ish. In chapter 20 of Mishlei, it says deep waters are in the heart of man. So what is it compared to? Leve'er amuka melea tzoin. That there's a deep well which is full of cold water. V'hayu me'me'a tzoninin v'yafin v'lo ha'isa b'riya yechol ishosimena. The well, the water was too deep that no one could get the water. Ba'echad v'kasher chevel. Someone came along and tied a rope b'chevel in another rope. V'nima b'nima. Another string to another string, Meshicha b'Meshicha, and then it kept pulling. V'dala himena v'shasa. After a while, they connected all these ropes together. They were able to bring it out. Hitchilu hakol dolin himena v'shasa, and then everybody else was able to drink from it. Kach lo zaz Yehuda meishiv liyosef davar al davar ad she'amar alibo. Yehuda keeps talking and talking and talking until he connects enough ropes together that it just pulls at Yosef's heartstrings. And the more he talks about it, the deeper he goes into the story, the more emotionally connected Yosef gets. Says the Ibn Ezra, that's what the Chacham is going to get in this situation. He might know all of the ins and outs of the world, but he's not necessarily going to understand it to the extent that he's going to motivate him on an emotional level. That's what the Chacham will get. And Pasuk Vav says, L'havin masho melitza divrei chacham v'chidosan, for understanding parables and epigrams, whatever that is, another type of idiom, I guess. Divrei chacham v'chidotam, the words of the scholars and their riddles. Some of the commentaries point out what this means is that many times Chazal talks in phrases that you can't understand on a surface level. So the wise person might know the words of Chazal, but he doesn't understand the depth of Chazal. So this book, even though the wise person might look at it and say, oh, I already know everything. So Shlomo Mel says, no, you don't know everything. You still need the tools to use your knowledge in order to interpret. You need the key to understanding. The very next pasuk, and this is really, that's really the beginning of the, that's really the completeness of the introduction, but in terms of how the psukim are laid out, this next pasuk is the last pasuk before the first break. It says the following, Yirat Hashem reshit dat, chachma u'musar avilim bazu. That how do you, what is the beginning of knowledge, the beginning of force, of knowing things, is Yiras Hashem. It's the ability to fear God. It's not a very intuitive phrase. Right, Rishis Chachma Yiras Hashem. Right, we say that in the morning. But what does it mean? Why do you need to fear God before you can have wisdom? You can learn a bunch of things before you ever even meet God. What does it mean that you have to have fear of God in order to be knowledgeable? So Rashi tells us the following. Why did Shlomo write this book? To finish off our introduction tonight. That the beginning of knowledge is the fear of heaven. That's the core of knowledge. It's going to put it in your heart to get wisdom. The people that are off, and they're not necessarily so righteous. So they're not fearing of heaven. When a fool looks at wisdom, they say, "Oh, what do I need it for?" It's a little cryptic about what Rashi is saying, but I think in source number 16, we can connect it to a modern concept of our brains. And I've seen this in a couple of places, and I just found it online in this website, mindsetworks.com. It says the following. Over 30 years, Carol Dweck and her colleagues became interested in students' attitudes about failure. They noticed that some students rebounded while other students seemed devastated by even the smallest setbacks. After studying the behavior of thousands of children, Dr. Dweck coined the term fixed mindset and growth mindset to describe underlying beliefs people have about learning and intelligence. I quoted a book on Shabbos called Grit by Angela Duckworth. She talks about this concept a lot, about how people have to develop the effort, which we'll talk about in a second. When they believe they can get smarter, they understand that effort makes them stronger. Therefore, they put in extra time and effort, and that leads to higher achievement. The research that they found is you can actually develop greater plasticity in your physical brain, that your brain capacity can actually grow, much like a muscle can grow when you make it work. Your brain can grow. You're not fixed in your intellect when you're born. We talked about this a little bit on Sunday morning, either this week or last week, with where the Piazes and the Rebbe's Chachma Chovas HaTalmidim. She says the following, in addition to teaching kids about malleable intelligence, research has started noticing that teacher practice has a big impact on student mindset, and the feedback that teachers give to their students can either encourage a child to choose a challenge and increase achievement, or look for an easy way out. For example, studies on different kinds of praise have shown that telling children they are smart encourages a fixed mindset. You tell a kid, wow, you're really smart, then they're not going to want to learn more. They're already smart. Right? They've defined what they are already. Whereas praising hard work and effort cultivates a growth mindset. You're doing really well. You're working really hard. It's great that you're putting in a lot of effort. Don't say you're at the pinnacle. Don't say you are smart. Say that you're working towards it. And that's a good thing. And when you encourage them in that way, when students have a growth mindset, they take on challenges and learn from them, therefore increasing their abilities and achievement. I believe this is what Rashi is talking about. That when Shlomo Amel says, Yiras Hashem Reishis Das, that the beginning of knowledge is a fear of heaven, the fear of heaven is your motivator. It's what brings you to the level of wanting to know more. That in order to grow, you have to have that core of a reason why you should grow. Because if you're just going to say, I'm going to give you a lot of knowledgeable stuff, so I already know a lot of knowledgeable stuff. The reason I'm going to read Mishle, the reason I'm going to look through the book and understand all these things is because I want to know more. But why do I want to know more? Because of Yiras Hashem. Because Hashem told you, you have an obligation to grow. You have a fear of heaven that is a calling in life. And without that core message of a calling, of a reason to grow, so then knowledge is just a fixed mindset. You're going to take what you get, and you're going to not take anything else. But if you have a reason to want more, so then that's going to continue your growth process, not only to know more, but also to advance your actual brain function, that your brain will become more, have a greater capacity to know more things. Yes, Steve?
Right, so taking in some of the other things that we said, yeah. Too, another additional aspect along with it would be we talked about Musa, we talked about focus, we talked about the fact that someone who's the less you know, the happier
you are. Right.
It's because you have no limitations, no parameters,
right.
no
goal.
Reining it in. Musa, knowledge of God, fear of God,
right.
Right. Gives you a focal point.
Right. When you have a goal that you're trying to get to, you have to stay within the lines. Otherwise, you're not necessarily going to get there. So definitely good point. So the introduction, or the end of our introduction tonight, which will continue next week, Monday night, is that before we start next week on the actual parables and the actual knowledge, we all have to get a little bit of fear of heaven. So hopefully we can all work on our emuna and our belief in 1 week. Hopefully I think we can get there, and we'll start next week to think about, to get more knowledge and to hopefully want to grow as we go week to week in this endeavor. Yes, thank you all for coming. And Emir Hashem, we'll see you next time. Yeah, right, exactly.
My first time.